Ja, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, herzlich willkommen hier heute Abend in der Bibliothek des Konservatismus zu unserer Buchvorstellung mit Douglas Murray, Der Selbstmord Europas, Immigration, Identität, Islam. Ein herzliches Willkommen natürlich auch dem Referenten des heutigen Abends, dear Mr. Murray. Welcome to the Library of Conservatism here in Berlin. We are glad that you are here and have taken the long distance from London to speak to us. Thank you very much. Die Trias Immigration, Identität und Islam beschreibt eines der drängendsten Probleme unserer Zeit. Doch Douglas Murray richtet den Blick nicht anklagend auf die, die da kommen, sondern auf die Volksvertreter in ganz Europa. Warum haben die europäischen Regierungen die Massenmigration angestoßen, wohlwissend, dass deren Folgen kurz-, mittel- und langfristig unabsehbar sind? Was bezwecken sie damit? Wir sind gespannt, welche Antworten uns unser Referent aufgrund seiner eingehenden Recherchen zu geben vermag. Douglas Murray wurde 1979 geboren und lebt in London. Er ist Mitherausgeber der konservativen britischen Zeitschrift The Spectator und schreibt regelmäßig für eine Reihe weiterer Publikationen. Noch ein Hinweis in eigener Sache: Bitte beachten Sie, dass private Ton- und Filmaufnahmen während der Veranstaltung heute Abend nicht gestattet sind. And now, dear Mr. Murray, I ask you for the floor.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening, and thank you so much for coming out. It's a great pleasure to be back in Berlin. I've been here quite a lot in recent years, but it's always an enormous pleasure to be back. I should apologize. First of all, I can read a little bit of German, but I can speak absolutely none, and I can understand very little, and I'm going to have to guess that what you just said was polite. We'll speak afterwards, maybe, if it was otherwise. But I was also asked, I normally speak from just from notes, and because I was aware that there would be a simultaneous translation in German, I've had to write out these remarks, but I'll stick as closely as possible to my my text. And also, I should say, I'm hoping to leave as much time as possible for questions and discussion after my initial remarks, because it's always a part, at any rate, that I find most interesting. Let me just get going. It's 2 years almost exactly now since The Strange Death of Europe was published in English. Since then, it's been translated, I think, into every European language. I think the Spanish are slightly slow, but apart from that, it'll have been every single one, I think, by the next few months. And it's also come out in German, of course, and in many other languages, including Korean, Chinese, Hebrew, and very soon Arabic, which I'm delighted by, I have to say. As those of you who have read the book will know, it covers the migration crisis not just of recent years, but of recent decades. And that's a crisis that I see as having sped up, though not necessarily reached a peak, which may yet be to come, in the events of 2015. And as well as describing what I saw firsthand, the points of entry in southern Europe, in Greece and Italy in particular, the book is also an attempt to reflect on the deeper crises and questions which I think are underlying this continent of ours. The thought I had constantly in 2015 and 16 as I was travelling was the same one that I'd had for years and I still have now. And it's something like this. Why would any society do this to itself? What is the aim? What is the limit? Are there any limits? And I try to encapsulate this in the book in the following question. Can Europe be the home for anyone in the world who wants to move in and call it their home? Now, our public and political discourse pretends that the answer to that question is yes. But I think that the answer is no. And I believe that most people in Europe, even many people in positions of power, once pushed on the question, will also answer no. But this means that we are confused. If the whole world cannot be there, but be here rather, then who can be here and why? And this is the much harder question, who cannot then be here? Obviously, the melding of asylum and economic migration and of legal and illegal immigration have made all this far harder to address than it should be. But at the root of the uncertainty is this uncertainty at who we should allow in and who should be kept out. And I understand this discomfort, especially perhaps here in Germany, about having any such discussion at all. But it seems to me that these are the sort of hard questions we have to be able to ask and indeed try to answer. A poll carried out by Gallup last year found that around one-third of all the people currently living in sub-Saharan Africa would like to move in the years ahead. So we better think about this better, deeper and faster than I think we've been willing to think about it over recent years. But perhaps I might mention at the outset the thing that's particularly struck me in the last couple of years. To be horribly reductionist, there's really two sides to my latest book. There is an us side and a them side. The them side is the consideration of the people who've come into Europe in recent years. The numbers, the origins, the causes, the consequences, and much more. In the responses to the book from some reviewers and also some people who've actually read it, focus has been mainly, indeed almost entirely, on this aspect of my work. It is understandable in many ways. It's a matter which has colossal impact and effects on the lives of all citizens in Europe, for the good as well as for the bad. And it is something which stirs great passions, again, for the good as well as for the bad. There are still people who claim that almost any discussion in this area is racist, or if not racist in itself, then likely to give rise to racism, proto-racism, racism facilitation, or racism adjacency, to adopt one of the new accusations, which means you were once standing beside somebody who could plausibly be described as racist. The people who deploy these accusations aim to effectively ring-fence or cordon off with a cordon sanitaire this great question of our time and preserve it from all and any reasonable challenge or discussion. I'm glad to see that across Europe these particular boundary police are everywhere losing their power. Nevertheless, there are very serious considerations arising from their concerns. We do indeed need to make sure that there are ways of thinking and speaking about migration that we find that do not alienate or make aliens of people who have been invited to Europe, have integrated into Europe, and who in many cases have given a great deal to Europe. So how do we ensure that we can make criticisms which are necessary without making judgments which are too sweeping or too uncomfortable? What's more, how do we avoid the legitimate part of that fear of some detractors and critics? How do we ensure that those extremist groups on the far right that do exist, to a greater or lesser degree in every society, get no opportunity to grow or get succour from the whole issue under discussion? Only, I would say, by allowing ourselves to think, speak, write, and discuss freely. And that includes the freedom and the right, indeed, to make mistakes, so that we work out as we go along what is sensible and decent debate and what is not. Shut the debate down, and you not only condemn our societies to repeat our mistakes of recent years, but you hand the best possible recruiting sergeant to those extremists that do exist, albeit in tiny numbers for now, thank goodness. But if there's any particular point of pride to me in the success of my book, it's really solely in the fact that so many people, from members of the public to politicians across Europe, have told me that it has helped them to some extent to think more deeply and speak more freely about some of these matters. However, as I say, this issue of immigration is, as I see it, only one half of the purpose of the book. The other half is the us part. What is it about us, the peoples of Europe, that would mean that we would open up our home to almost anybody in the world who wants to come here? First, by inviting large worker populations. These people, as Chancellor Merkel said in her 2010 Potsdam speech, were not expected to stay. But very predictably, of course, now we realize they did stay. And then over time, this idea slipped into allowing migrants to come to Europe even if there wasn't a job for them, or if they had none of the necessary qualifications or competencies to get a job. And from there, we ended up in the surge of 2015, a surge, I'd remind people, that meant by the EU and Frontex, the border agency's own figures, a majority of those who arrived in 2015, that's at least 60% by the Frontex figures, had no more right to be in Europe than anyone else in the rest of the world. That is, people who had no asylum claim, but who are coming to Europe because they believe they can have a better life here. How did we get to that situation? This question, I have to say, just fascinates me and continues to fascinate me on my travels because, after all, it is a very unusual situation, historically, for a society to find itself in. To invite people in who cannot pay for themselves and who in many cases have no particular desire or capability to integrate into the society they have come to is a very strange thing for a society to do. In many ways, it's a mystery, but not, I think, a complete mystery. About a year after my book came out, I was speaking with an Austrian acquaintance, a scientist who has no involvement and not much interest in politics. Why, he asked me, did the migration of 2015 occur? And among my many answers was, I said, and obviously the war. Which war, he said. Well, the Second World War, I replied, at which he just burst out with uncontrollable laughter. Now, of course, I don't want to read too much into the laughter of one Austrian scientist, but I understood it, and it spoke to something that was one of the things that's been much on my mind since I've been arguing about the contents of this book with various critics. See, we all know, and I don't need to tell you, that the last century still hovers over everything, as perhaps it should. It's not as though we're that far away from it. So we're still trying to work out what our reaction to that century ought to be. That is why I spend a whole chapter of my book on the question of guilt, historical guilt. Again, it's a subject which the average German knows much more about than the average non-German, but it's sometimes necessary to identify the thing right beneath your nose, even when you are tired of it. In the reactions of some Germans to the arrival of trains into Munich and other stations in 2015, I saw something that was so far beyond ordinary behaviour that it required not a social scientist or a writer, but a psychiatrist. It's not normal. It's not normal that when unidentified people, mainly men, from a bewildering array of countries, come into your country, that you should welcome them as though they were a football team, returning to their hometown after an unexpected triumph. It's not normal that members of the public should give grown adults teddy bears and high-five them and much, much more, unless it's the playing out of something very much deeper and more psychologically based than the ordinary run of our politics. The sheer joy of some of the Germans at those stations, seeing people breaking into their country rather than trying to break out. And of course, we now know from some of those around her at the time that one of the main reasons Chancellor Merkel would not uphold normal border procedures at the end of 2015's August was because she did not want footage going around the world of German border guards turning away migrants. So this is one very clear explanation for what happened in 2015 and for what is still happening today, because we have still not worked out what our attitude should be towards the past. And perhaps we never will. We may remain curiously stuck in the situation of needing to seek redemption. It may be psychologically as well as philosophically understandable, but it's necessary to examine this to work out where it leads and if it has any endpoint other than at the point of complete societal negation. In a lecture titled Labour, Work, Action, given in 1964, Hannah Arendt addressed a portion of this issue. Specifically, she referred to forgiveness itself as being the only mechanism we've come up with as a species to deal with our appalling inability to predict the consequences of our actions in the world. If there are people who are beyond forgiveness or who think that they are unable ever to receive forgiveness, then perhaps it is inevitable that those people would, in some numbers at least, behave in a way that suggested that they were unbothered by the consequences of extreme actions. We also need to wonder carefully, I suggest, whether Nietzsche was right in his prediction that a post-Christian society could retain some of the trappings of Christianity, including the Christian conception of guilt, but lose all of the means of expiation, such as in any form of divine forgiveness. What a trap this is to find ourselves in, stuck with a burden that can never be alleviated. But the whole issue of guilt, and indeed forgiveness, is just one aspect of the us portion of what I'm interested in. I've also made sure to include long sections on an issue which has come to fascinate me in recent years. It's the issue which I refer to in my book as European tiredness. Existential tiredness. Part of this is obviously connected to the tyranny of guilt. I use the German term in my book, which translates as weariness with history. Clearly, a part of the existential tiredness I describe comes from the weight of the past, but it's not only that. It also comes, I believe, from a fear that there is no way out of the situation we've come to find ourselves in, or that all the options that have been tried and each of them has led, one after another, to disaster. I'm very fond of an analogy that the French philosopher Chantal Delsol used in a book written in the 1990s. Her analysis, written in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall, was that modern European mankind finds itself in the position that Icarus would have been in had he survived the fall. That is, we dreamt all of these dreams, religious, national, political, utopian, and by rights, perhaps we shouldn't have survived them at all. All these races to the sun. And yet we did survive them. And we find ourselves here, bruised, battered, singed of wing, but still alive. So what do we do? One answer, which Delsol saw in the 1990s, and she saw was one of the solutions that the Soviet officials who'd seen the emptiness of their own vision had already arrived at, is simply to have fun. To date, this is just about the only life justification we've settled on in Western Europe over the last 30 years. And so long as living standards rise for the rest of time, the rest of possible time, it would potentially remain a solution with a following. But it is striking, this loss of purpose. Striking because there is also that thing that I call the sense that the story might have run out. I don't have time here to go into the full detail of what I mean by that phrase, but I attempt to show that it's totalistic. It's a sense which permeates all of our artistic culture, our musical, literary, and visual arts culture. The sense that the best has been done and thought and said, and that we are left playing around in the debris, making not very convincing additions to the rubble. It is my own view that German art, especially in Richter and Kiefer, among others, both epitomise and in some ways carefully give an answer to this conundrum. But I believe that the same sense can be heard in much of academia. There was a pivotal point in my thinking on some of this at a colloquium at Heidelberg that I was involved in some years ago as a participant. In that room, I describe in the book the full horror of German thought that came cascading down on me in that room. The realization that not just all of the most interesting ideas were cordoned off, as if there was police crime scene tape around them, but that whole words and concepts. At one point I used the term culture and there was an almost complete breakdown in the room. It was as if it was a tedious cascade of deconstructionism was still going on, post-colonial theorizing and so on, a sort of playing around with uninteresting things and pretending they were interesting, all the time avoiding what mattered. It's not only at Heidelberg, I should stress, that this happens, or universities as a whole, but this suspicion towards all ideas, language, now seems to me to dominate everywhere. It's a matter of almost every day's news in the media and newspapers, and they delight in their newly rediscovered role as policemen of our language and discourse. Whole schools of reporters and editors seem poised not just to accuse particular ideas of coming back around again, but to claim to hear errant phrases. Beneath or above those levels, there's also the new fondness for claiming that other pitches can be heard in the discussion, beyond the normal level of human audibility. That thing now known as the dog whistle, where a person can claim to be using a term or phrase in a particular way that speaks over the heads and ears of ordinary people straight into some rabid, waiting, obedient dog who's going to be promptly ordered to commit some fresh kind of horror. Of course, these people always forget that the nature of the dog whistle is that if you hear the whistle, you are the dog. But anyhow, is it any wonder that there's a sense of weariness, if not tiredness, that should come from all this? The fact that we've closed off not just ideas, but language itself, and turned what is behind that closed door, that police-cordoned tape, into this heavily mined area. I think we find ourselves in the position that chess players among you will know as Zugzwang, the position where you have to move, but no position you can move to could possibly improve your situation. What precisely are we supposed to do caught in this era of Zugzwang? As I hinted at the beginning, I've been fascinated by the fact that almost nobody has picked up this half of the argument, half the point of my book. Even the more hostile critics have not bothered to pick a fight with me over this analysis. And if I may be so bold, I think there's a reason, which is not that they have some brilliant counter-argument against it that could prove that they are right and I am wrong, and that they are just keeping this up their sleeves. I think the reason they're not picking me up on this aspect is because they realize that I'm right, which is a great disappointment to me, I must say, on this occasion. In lieu of any other ideas about what to do with ourselves, I believe that the era of mass immigration has come about in part because it is something new to do. The fact that it was not intended or planned can be told, among other things, by the fact that the answers as well as the justifications have kept on changing. As I often say, I blame no immigrant into Europe of recent decades for being confused about what has been asked of them. After all, we ourselves moved, in a matter of years, just in the course of my own lifetime, from 1, we didn't expect you to stay, 2, you're staying, fine, do what you like, 3, become like us. If we had been serious about any of this, or thought any of it through, we would have anticipated the problems in so rapidly shifting our explanations of what we were doing. Or we would have known what we were doing. And we didn't. Instead, we fell into an improvisatory era, by the end of which we shifted our whole definition of ourselves. Without any public consultation or approval, we transformed our societies from Britain, Germany, Denmark, or wherever, into multicultural societies, as though diversity had been the plan all along, from the era of the Gastarbeiter right up to the present. We have a phrase in English that a change is as good as a rest, and the multicultural era often seems to me to be an attempt to demonstrate this saying. It may be complex, it may be difficult, it may not work, but at least it's interesting. I find it fascinating, this state orthodoxy of our time, and not only because of its glaring contradictions. Everywhere in Europe that I go, it is the same. Or very slightly different stages of exactly the same process. But everywhere the presumption has been pushed out, and will, I suggest, have a particularly negative effect on the young generations now coming up, which says that basically Europe alone, of all places in the world, is really rather stale and boring. Unlike the fascinating, often not diverse, but at least not European portions of the world, Europe needs migrants because it makes us better people. They make us more cultured, more interesting, and more tolerant, among many other things. At least this is what the orthodoxy demands we believe. Now, of course, it would be thought rather rude to go to sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, note the relative lack of Europeans, and suggest to them that if they really want to be successful, or indeed interesting, they could do with an injection of Germans into their neighbourhood. Nobody preaches that the Chinese should become a migrant society, because they need to become more diverse. Nobody thinks that China's success or otherwise in the coming decades depends on whether it can be more multicultural or diverse. This idea, these themes, are, I suggest, only really ever practiced on Europeans. And I think it is understandable if Europeans, especially younger Europeans, begin to notice this and become increasingly resentful about the deal that they're being offered. There is, a follow-on question as well, of course, which is exceptionally difficult to address, which may be why people don't bother to address it. But it's this: if diversity is such an unalloyed good, is there any limit to the benefits it brings? Is there any stage at which a society has had enough diversity, or must more always mean better? One point I try to make on this is that it is hard, like all hard questions, for very good reasons. A certain amount of diversity does bring certain benefits. It allows us to learn things we may not have learned and develop understandings we may not otherwise have acquired. But once we've got those ideas, once we've learned what can be learned from the arrivals from a particular place, it's not clear to me that it's the case that the next 100 people bring 100 times the same amount of benefit, or that 1 million in a year, to pluck a number from the air, increase our learning 1 million times over. Rather, it seems to me that the benefits on a cultural level flatten out fairly fast. Now, exactly when or where is not at all clear, but the fact that these particular benefits diminish at some stage seems to me to be irrefutable. And then there's the most difficult question of all in all of this. If a society benefits culturally from a certain amount of immigration, is the benefit the same from each and every place? Is it the case that the first 1,000 Eritreans to arrive in Germany bring in the same amount of cultural advantage as, say, the first 1,000 Japanese or Chinese? How do we identify this? And are we at any stage allowed to say what we find as a result? Almost certainly not, or at least not for the foreseeable future. For the foreseeable future, it's necessary to stress the benefits of all immigration and stress that the benefits which accrue come about absolutely equally from each culture and country on the planet. It is an uncomfortable position, but it's the one we've decided to settle on. Now, I'm conscious I should start to try to wrap up these opening remarks and hand over to you for questions, but before I do, I should mention that there is one other aspect to all of this which I encounter wherever I go, and if I don't address it in my remarks, I'll certainly get it in questions, so let me preempt it. The question is usually something like this: why is Eastern Europe different? This, I have to say, is, I think, a fascinating question, and one which takes an awfully long time for me to answer in full. But it's striking because it's so obvious to anybody who travels in Europe these days. As part of my work, I find myself still in a different European country every week or so, and I have the enormous pleasure in continuing to follow all of the trends I write about in my book. But this trend in particular, the difference between East and West Europe, just seems to me to get more marked with every visit. Central and Eastern Europe, especially the Visegrad group, have undoubtedly decided to take a different path from the western half of Europe. They've seen us struggle with immigration, they've seen us struggle with integration, they've weighed up the benefits, and they've listened to their publics, and they've decided that they will not go the way that we have gone. But this decision is not solely an East-West divide. It is one that exists to a certain degree, and a fascinating degree, in other often apparently similar countries. I was in Denmark again last week, and it seems to me that the futures of Denmark and Sweden, for instance, are likely to be very different in the years ahead. Having had something of a warning shot in 2005 with the cartoons crisis, the Danes decided, broadly speaking, to be very careful about continuing to make some of the presumptions that their neighbours were still very gleefully making. And so, in 2015, while Sweden, like Germany, chose to put itself at the front of the queue of countries willing to accept whoever walked into them, Denmark chose to duck. I think they made a wise choice, obviously. But, I say this in closing, it's a reminder that the decisions about which people are often fatalistic in Europe, or think these decisions are taken at too high a political level, can, in fact, be affected by the governments and by the peoples of individual countries. That is, I think, as it should be, and is a cause for a small amount of optimism to end on. I hand over to you. Thank you.